bitch on me, get no flexing on me. My attorney gon' call and collect. Blessings on blessings for me. My success has only made him envious.
What is up, everyone?
I had to put all their egos in check. I want the money to pay respect. And I heard you know so-and-so, you're not a threat. Cause I really know so-and-so, they like my
family. It's been a while, it's been a minute. Unintentionally, I had a bit of a FUBAR situation. I actually did a podcast a couple weeks ago with the Hated One. It was really good. And I exported the podcast directly to an external hard drive because I was planning to edit it on a camping trip and upload it while I was there. And everything checked out fine. But when I plugged the external SSD in, the files were gone. Lesson learned. And I had nuked my SD card thinking like, okay, everything's safe. I've exported the podcast over. And so I formatted the SD card. For those that care, I record the podcast generally on a Rodecaster Pro and it records directly to SD card, which is what I like. I can do everything on the board and then I can plug it into other devices and things like that. So normally I'll export the podcast out and then format the card, free the card up for next time. Well, I had formatted it and the podcast was gone. So my apologies to the Hated One and everyone who was looking forward to that episode. We're going to record again sometime in the future, but that also pushed the schedule out that I was planning on for my publishing calendar and therefore left like a month of gap. So that was unintentional. That was just my own idiotic self not using the 3-2-1 rule for my podcast files. So if I do come across them magically, I've gone through everything looking for them. Maybe I accidentally exported to a different location. No, I cannot find them anywhere. So I feel really bad about that. And it was a real bummer because I had a really good time talking to the Hated One and that was going to be episode 35. So for now, I've got another episode put together. Some things I want to talk about that are really important, but yeah, I apologize. The Hated One, I'm sorry. And to those who knew that we were going to be talking, I also apologize because, yeah, I missed the boat on that due to my own fail. So this is episode 35, recorded today, Wednesday, June 19th, 2024. This was going to be kind of like the mid-year privacy check-in, which was kind of what I was originally planning. I'm still going to talk about some of those things as well as what's on the horizon in the EU with the chat control bill that I believe is being decided tomorrow, as well as some other things about just, you know, a couple news items that have to do with privacy, one around data breaches, which I'm not a huge like news feed podcast on talking about data breaches, but this one I think is kind of interesting because of the nature of it. I'm going to talk about the mandatory internet ID checks that are kicking off in California, as well as other states that this is getting kind of into a weird space where adult content sites are going to have to actually ask for a KYC ID check in certain states in order to view the content on the site, which on the surface, people might think, well, that's not all bad, right? Like, but at the same time, it can kind of lead into some weird places. And so we're going to talk about that. Also, Google's massive leak of its search algorithm documentation. We're going to talk about Manifest V2 and Manifest V3 and ad blocking and how it's going to impact your browser experience, especially if you're using a Chromium-based browser. My pseudo, I've gotten alerts in the last week. Others have as well for UK numbers that are going to need to be KYC'd if you want to keep those phone numbers, as well as going to touch on some tech. Gosh, it's a lot I actually have in here. Hopefully I can get to it all. Talking about tech, specifically about Microsoft rolling back its controversial, you know, what they call Windows recall feature, as well as my thoughts about Apple and its AI rollout, what they're you know, what they're calling Apple Intelligence, to refer to the Apple Intelligence experience into their platform and their OS across all their devices, as well as incorporating ChatGPT. Maybe a little bit about my privacy plan that I'm working on for the remainder of 2024. This is kind of like a mid-year check-in, things that I'm doing, what I might recommend for others to do. Though, take everything I recommend with a grain of salt, because I don't know everyone's specific threat model, your needs, what you're trying to, you know, shield from, and from whom. So kind of the pretext of this is privacy isn't about hiding, but more about revealing what you want to whom, or, you know, what terms that you want to reveal that data. So that's kind of the premise of this episode. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about. For those that have been supporting the show, I greatly appreciate you. Michael Bates, Richard G, and some of the other Patreon supporters. Those two are at the Privacy Badass level. Really appreciate the support. Also had some new Lightning boosters in the last month. So I'm going to rattle those off, as I appreciate all of the support. It's coming from Bond, Wartime, Circus Media, I don't want to mess up, The Tone Wrecker, Vake, I'm not really sure, V-A-K-E, Lumor, Turnbull, The Presidents, Steve the Zebra, and Mix. I wanted to give a shout out for those boosting through a Podcast 2.0 app. These were on Fountain. I like Fountain. I know it's not open source. I also really like AntennaPod, as well as Podverse. I've been kind of bouncing around between Podverse and Fountain, because Fountain has a better user experience if you're a podcaster, as well as a podcast listener, but especially as a podcaster, because I can see in real time with comments and respond to those comments when people boost episodes of the show. And so, though I try to use open source software in most cases where I can, I also like those features. So for me, I have been using Fountain to be able to interact, like those comments, boost comments back to other podcasters and things of that nature. So anyways, that's where those contributions are coming from when I rattle those off, those lightning boosts. So thank you to all of those people. And thank you to our moderators and our admins, specifically Unintelligent Seven and Maddest Max, who are always helping out and welcoming people and banning people when needed in our Matrix channels. We have two Matrix chat channels where you can come in and just, it's kind of a stream of consciousness between everybody. I think last time I checked earlier today, we're around 255 people or so in our chat, which is very active. And we also have an off-topic chant for, you know, all the memes and all that stuff. So all of the links to this will be in the show notes. The show notes are actually also hosted on our forum, which I started doing about four or five episodes ago. So if you just click the very first link in the show notes, it'll take you to our forum post for this episode, and everything should be a lot easier to click on from there, because I know sometimes in the show notes in different podcast apps, the links don't get the hyperlink tags around them. So I'm trying to make that a little bit easier. And also to our admins on the forum, Seven, Mattis Max, and Water Turkey. The forum is just kind of a newer tool we've recently added just in the last couple of months to some of the different places where we can all communicate and compile information and things of that nature. So writing tutorials and how-tos or other things, even other podcasts that I like to listen to, I've posted there. That's just at forum.closenetwork.io. You can get to all the links to all the things I talk about from the show notes and from closenetwork.io. You can go to the episode description and click and get to everything. So also, we've been really having a good time with the SimpleX group, the SimpleX chat group. I think we're sitting somewhere around like 25 to 30 people in there. I haven't really been pushing that a whole lot. It's been kind of an experiment to test how well SimpleX works for kind of collaborative communication, like almost like if you're used to Telegram, right? And I say Telegram because it's just one room that you're in, like a channel, as opposed to something like Discord, where you have multiple channels on a server. So that's been very active. And every time I pop in there, there's some really cool conversations happening in there. Sometimes a little more techy, a little more nerdy on just how to set servers up and self-hosting and things of that nature. But it's been a blast kind of being in multiple spaces. It's a little bit to keep up with sometimes, but you know, join where it makes sense for you if you want to participate and ask questions or engage with other like-minded individuals. So I don't have a link to that in the show notes, but I might add it, or you can just hit us up in the Matrix channel and we'll make sure to get that to you. So that pretty much covers all of the introduction. I, on just a very high level tidbit, because I'm very excited, I did have some positive news this week from my orthopedic surgeon who performed the knee surgery on me when I tore my ACL and had a meniscus tear back in December. And then I had the surgery in January. He's like, I got the clear to run and bike again. So I went for my first official run yesterday. I'm super stoked. Definitely out of shape, but I almost did 5 miles. I was really just happy. I'm just happy to be able to do that. So I signed up for a 10K and then about a month and a half, just to have something on the calendar to look forward to and to get in better shape for. So for those who enjoy running, hey, I'm back in the game. So yeah, I'm going to kind of just get right into some of the bits about this. Some of the things that are coming up, because they're kind of time sensitive, especially the chat control bill. And now that's affecting the European Union, but often those things kind of trickle over. And then in the United States, there's some other things going on with, you know, having to identify yourself if you want to visit certain websites, specifically in this case, adult content sites. I'm not going to name them. You know what they are likely, but there's a lot of, you know, adult sites will say that you normally would, you know, just click I'm an 18 or above or something like that, and then you can go into the site. And now they're going to be asking you to validate yourself with an ID. So this is happening in different states. It's not like a federal thing in the United States, but last I read, it was like Kentucky, California, where you're going to have within the next 8 to 10 days, this is going into effect. So those are the mandatory ID checks on the chat control bill. I think is, I don't know if it's like what they call it, a bill, but it's a ruling of some kind or I don't know. Like I know in the United States, they're called bills. Actually, let me just pull this up real quick, because I have an article from Threema that came out yesterday, 2 days ago. And I wanted to see what they called it. Yeah, it is a bill. Okay, I guess it is called a bill. So actually, I'm going to go right into that. And then I'm going to pop back over. I'm going to kind of be out of order of my notes, so I apologize for that. But this chat control measure, there are places where you can, you know, sign. I think the EFF has something, Threema has something. I'll have links in the description where you can go and actually say like, hey, I don't agree with this. But the legislative proposal known as the chat control, the EU Commission is trying to establish an unprecedented mass surveillance apparatus, like on another level. So if you're an EU citizen and you're not standing up for your privacy, this might happen as tomorrow. So actually, it was supposed to happen today, June 19th, but I think in some other news articles I was reading, I also saw June 20th. So it might be happening today, or it might be happening tomorrow, and I'm going to be following this outcome to see if it's going to pass or not, and if so, when is it going to be implemented? So I'm just going to kind of read through a brief summary of this. Let's see. The consequences of this could be devastating under the pretext of child protection, right? So this is kind of falling under the CSAM stuff, which is the child sexual abuse material content. What, you know, the idea is that they're saying we need this bill and we need this implemented so we can stop, put an end to child exploitation, which, sure, most people would want to stop child exploitation for sure. This just isn't the way to go about it. So EU citizens would no longer be able to communicate in a safe, private manner on the internet. So the European market's location advantage would suffer a massive hit due to a substantial decrease in data security. And EU professionals like lawyers, journalists, and physicians would no longer be able to upload or uphold their duty to, you know, confidentiality online. It really wouldn't exist. So all while, you know, children wouldn't be better protected in this scenario, but kind of conversely, the chat control would have a negative impact on minors in particular. So let's just, what is chat control? What are we talking about? So the EU Commission's proposed child sexual abuse regulation, commonly known as chat control, aims to combat the circulation of CSAM, which I mentioned, child sexual abuse material, on digital platforms by requiring service providers to implement some sort of detection mechanism that automatically scans users' media and messages for both known and potential CSAM and report detected cases to authorities. So we're talking about client-side scanning is what we're talking about here. The scanning, well, the reason why it's called client-side scanning is because the technology for this scanning would happen on your device. Let's just use your mobile phone for this instance, because that's probably where a lot of your communications is happening. So it's scanning your messages and your media on your device before it's transmitted. So even if you're using end-to-end encrypted applications, it would still encrypt your communication in transit, but what it's talking about is actually scanning it before it's even sent. So it doesn't matter how the EU Commission is trying to sell it. It's basically, an upload moderation, or they're going to use some sort of AI detection. And we're going to talk a little bit about some AI stuff later. So it is a mass surveillance tool because it's not, it's looking at everything. Right. And in order for it to check against known or even unknown content that it would deem in violation or, a reason to investigate, it has to see that before it gets sent. So not exactly sure what the implementation would look like, because that would be something that would have to be figured out later if this goes through. And what's interesting about this is that the EU now has had some successful wins with big tech companies like Apple App Store, sideloading apps, as well as forcing Apple to standardize on USB-C on their hardware. So when, it's such a big populace, the European Union, to not be able... What I'm saying is that if this passes, Apple's going to have to find a way, Google's going to have to find a way to appease the law. And oftentimes, something on that scale would just be rolled out in like an OS update. And if the functionality exists, how do you have it on for one country and off? And I know that EU is multiple countries. So I'm just saying, if the European Union passes this, if you're in the EU, does this mean if you're in the United States, it's not client-side scanning, but what if you travel to the EU and now it's going to unlock that feature, like an on or off mode behind the scenes based on your geolocation? I have no idea. I don't think anyone really knows, because we just have to speculate what this means. But this has a massive impact to every traditional major tech player that's providing hardware and communication platforms for communication. So this is like really a big deal, because I know some people might say, well, if it passes in the EU, I don't live there, so it wouldn't impact me. I disagree, because I think at some point, it's going to become easier to just make the operating system and the feature set just available everywhere. Now, they may not have it enabled where you live if you're not in the EU, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be still used, or maybe it's just not being actively scanned, but it's the functionality would be baked in to the operating system. So I'm really not sure how that would would be handled. I don't think many people would right now. And of course, you know, because this article says, of course, sharing sea salmon is an absolutely intolerable, horrific crime that must be punished. And I agree. Before sea salmon can be shared online, however, a child must have suffered abuse in real life, which is what effective child protection should be trying to prevent. And what chat control does not focus on, it doesn't focus on stopping the abuse. It's trying to address sharing after the fact, right? So for this and many other reasons, child protection organizations such as Germany's, you know, Federal Child Protection Association are against chat control, arguing it's neither, you know, proportionate or effective. And besides, there's no way of really knowing whether the chat control would actually be or remain limited to CSAM. So, you know, this, once this is implemented under the guise of CSAM detection, what's to stop them from saying, well, we want to include explosives or firearms or perceived violence or anything, memes, maybe political memes. Like, there's no way to stop what could be captured at that point, because now it's just scanning everything on the device. That's another big problem, right? So it's not going to be just limited to CSAM at some point. At least I wouldn't believe that. And it's, you know, once the mass surveillance apparatus is installed, it could easily be extended to detect content from anything else without anyone noticing it. So from a service provider's point of view, the detection mechanism, which is created and maintained by third parties, essentially behaves like a black box, because they don't really, like the service providers being like that, maybe being like Apple or Facebook or Google or something like that, wouldn't really know, because it's being offloaded or handled by like this third party vendor, whoever the government would pay to do this technology implementation. Yeah, I don't know. So I'm going to read this, because this is from Threema. Threema is an end-to-end encrypted chat messenger. I don't personally use them, but they're very popular, very similar to like Signal or Session or something like that. So Threema's stance is, while Threema would be subject to chat control, the business solution Threema Work would be out of scope according to their current knowledge base. It says it's not entirely clear how chat control would have to be implemented by service providers, and it's questionable whether such blatant violation of the right to privacy would hold up in the European courts. What is crystal clear, however, is that there will never be a Threema version, this is their sales pitch, that's spying on its users in any way, shape, or form. The reason Threema was created is to provide a highly secure, completely private, and anonymous means of communication. Once it's no longer possible to offer such a service in the European Union, we will be forced to take consequences. So I assume they mean like shut down, or at least shut down their service in that region. We will carefully consider all options, including legal actions, technical workarounds, etc. first. And we come to the conclusion that there's no other way. We'll call the fellow communication services to join us in leaving the EU. And well, we've seen here in the United States, under cryptocurrency companies leaving the United States for other types of forecasted potential roadblocks that they're going to run into, as far as like software companies that write software for Bitcoin wallets, especially using the Lightning Network. That's a different subject that I have talked about ad nauseum in other episodes, but it's kind of the same thing, right? Where companies are trying to figure out like, well, if this legislation passes here, we may either have to alter our products or our services, or we'll have to just leave and offer our products and services to potential customers in other regions that aren't impacted by this type of legislation. I mean, that's just a survival technique. I mean, it makes sense, but at some point, if you're in any kind of civilized world where, you know, governments are working with nation state governments in cooperation with surveillance of their citizens and journalists and things of that nature, I think you're going to run out of places to hide, or you're going to move to places that are not going to be conducive for your service or application to become and remain successful. So I think really the best thing to do is try to fight this as best as possible. And that means by reaching out to your legislative bodies, wherever you are, your representatives and voicing your opinion and letting them know that you do not want this to pass and that you are, you want to protect your rights to privacy and your capabilities to communicate freely with your friends, loved ones, coworkers without feeling or being surveilled on that level. And that, I mean, that's my suggestion. And so there are links to where to do that on this article, which this article will be posted, like I said, in the show notes below. It's the Threema article. Also, Tuda Mail put out a YouTube video on chat control just yesterday or the day before. That is also going to be in the show notes. I'm not going to go through it, but I just found it very insightful because I think the guy's name is Peter Byrne. Peter Byrne. He works with EU legislators as like a negotiator, and he had some really good insights about what this bill is, what they're trying to accomplish, and why it's bad for everybody. So if you get a second, well, it's going to take a few seconds. I think it's about a 30-minute video. But if you're the type of person that just likes to watch or listen to things, I wanted to put that in there because that is something you could just put on in the background, just listen and absorb and try to understand what's going on with that. So switching over to some news about this data breach that I wanted to cover because data breaches happen all the time. But this one was interesting that stood out to me because it was a data analytics company that got hacked. And as much as like 10 different companies are being extorted with the data because this is a data collection company called Snowflake. So cyber criminals are demanding payments between $300,000 and $5 million US a piece from as many as 10 companies breached in a campaign targeted at Snowflake Inc. And I'll talk about what Snowflake is in just a second. Their customers, according to a security firm helping with the investigation, the hacking scheme entered a new stage as they kind of look at profiting from the most valuable information that it has stolen from Snowflake Inc. And Austin Larson, who's a senior threat analyst at Google's security business team, helped lead Snowflake's inquiry. So this is kind of from him saying, "We anticipate the actor to continue to attempt to extort victims," Larson said. So Snowflake is a cloud-based data analytics firm. And on June 2nd, or at least that's the date that they're telling us, hackers had launched a targeted campaign against them, against this company, that was basically exploited a single-factor authentication to access their data. And the hacking group stole login details to access Snowflake accounts, as many as 165 customers. And they basically took a ton of data. So the reason why this is interesting is because this is a data broker. So data brokers are going to collect data from a multitude of places. So it's not just like one social network getting hacked or something like that. This company basically acquires data. They buy it. They acquire it. They probably have their own ad networks that are then in turn digesting all of this information. And then they are normalizing this data oftentimes and putting it into different types of data warehouses or data marts that basically allow the sale of access to it. So if you go to Snowflake's website, some of the things that they offer are like as far as like industries or like advertising, media and entertainment, financial services, healthcare services, manufacturing, public sectors, retail, technology, telco, IT, all that kind of stuff. So they're basically able to use this data to help target different industries or verticals based upon what marketing needs that you might have. So when they get hacked, it's kind of like this massive field day because there's information and data that's come from all different types of sources, sources that were likely secure when the information was being inputted or gathered there. But, you know, a lot of these companies work in a data revenue model, meaning they're generating some sort of revenue or profit from the data that they're collecting, because a lot of these services are free. As you've heard probably many times, you know, if the product is free, then you are the product, and that's what happens. So when a company like this gets hacked, the data breach could actually be a multitude of times worse than just a single endpoint getting breached, like, you know, one provider or one service provider, because this is actually data from a multitude of providers. So think of it as like a wheel spoke, or like a hub in a wheel, where all the spokes that are connected to it, if that fails, then kind of like all of the spokes connected are going to be exposed. So I don't really know a lot. I mean, and some big companies use this, like MasterCard, Capital One, Roku, DoorDash, Albertsons, colleges, Adobe, AT&T. So there are over 7,000 brands that mobilize what they call mobilize their data with Snowflake, New York Stock Exchange, Comcast, just NBC Universal, Cisco, Electronic Arts for those that are into gaming. I mean, this could be bigger than we know yet. And I'm not trying to use like fear mongering or scare tactics. I don't really know the level. I'm actually been trying to see if I could find more information on the data leaks, which is getting harder because all the breach forums keep getting shut down. So yeah, so it's a little bit harder having to spend more time on the dark net and doing some investigating there, mostly within, you know, the forums and things, and just trying to understand, like, does this mean like all of these companies client data was exposed? I'm not entirely sure, but it seems to be pretty impactful. So I'm going to keep kind of trying to follow this story as best as I can. And if I have updates for it, I'll be sure to talk about it in an upcoming episode. All right. So getting back to kind of the privacy news, I want to talk about this California mandatory internet ID check. So this is an article on the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I'll have linked below per use. This article came out 2 days ago. Actually, this one came out yesterday. So California lawmakers are debating an ill-advised bill that would require internet users to show their ID in order to look at sexually explicit content. The EFF has sent a letter to the California legislators encouraging them to oppose Assembly Bill 3080, which would have the result of censoring the internet for all users. So, and I know, right? Like, a lot of people are like, well, I mean, it's a porn site. Like, do we really care? Yes, we do care. And this article is going to tell us why, right? So if you care about free and open internet for all, and especially if you're a California resident, now would be a good time to contact your assembly member or senator and let them know you oppose this particular bill 3080. So if this passes, it would make it illegal to show websites with 1/3 or more sexually explicit content to minors. These explicit websites would join a list of products or services that can't be legally sold to minors, which, I mean, it really shouldn't be anyways, but in California, including things like firearms, ammunition, tobacco, e-cigarettes, this is going to cover a lot more than just the sexually explicit content, but anything that like would be illegal to sell to anyone under 18 years old, essentially. So these things are not the same and should not be treated as the same under the state or federal law. Adults have a First Amendment right to look for information online, including sexual content. So one of the reasons EFF has opposed mandatory age verification is because there's no way to check ID online just for minors without like a big harm to the rights of adults to get information and consume information or even browse online anonymously. So this is going to be gatekeeping content to people who are only willing to ID themselves or KYC themselves. So the EFF explained in a recent amicus briefing on the issue, collecting ID online is fundamentally different and more dangerous than in-person ID checks in a physical world, meaning like you go into a store to buy cigarettes or something, you show them your ID and they look at your birthday and they look at you and they look at the card and they're like, okay, cool. And so that's what it's saying, you know, in the physical world where you're just showing it versus you're uploading it to an unknown destination, right? And we're talking about government-issued IDs being uploaded to where? A third-party verifier, right? So it would be some sort of third party, which you have no idea what the data retention is, how long it's stored, how it's stored, is it encrypted, who has access to it, when is it purged? Because really, they only need you to verify for the moment. So, but that probably wouldn't happen here. It's going to absolutely probably go into a database of who you were, the time that it was verified, what site or what service it was verified, and it will be forever stored as a permanent record about you. So the more information a website collects about visitors, I'm just going back to the article here, the more chances there are for such data to get into the hands of a criminal or other bad actor or a marketing company. So, or someone who's filed a subpoena for it, especially like a FOIA request. And so so-called anonymized data can be reassembled, especially when it consists of data-rich government ID together with browsing data like an IP address, date and timestamp, what you looked at. It wouldn't be that hard to correlate that information. So it goes on to say data breaches are a fact of life, and I agree with that. Once governments insist on creating these ID logs for visiting websites with sexual content, those data breaches will become more dangerous because now criminals just have to go after one centralized service. Typically, it's going to be the verified or the vendor that's doing the verification service on behalf of the website. That would be a target-rich environment for criminals because most of the time, criminals are trying to get information where they can emulate someone's real-world identification. They can be that person online. They can open up credit cards. They can try to access bank account information and other sensitive financial records to enrich their life from stealing that person's identity. So this is a really scary precedent. And also, I had mentioned earlier in the podcast, I had the... there's an article on 404 Media that's also talking about Kentucky and Indiana and having to do an ID verification to access websites. It's also in Louisiana. It looks like Louisiana and Kentucky have reported on the change. And this is actually going into effect. Like, this is actually going to happen in like the next 8 days as of July 10th. It says, I'm just going to read an excerpt from this 404 Media article. Sorry, I'm bouncing around, but they're on the same topic. It says, did you know your government wants you to give your driver's license before you can access Pornhub? The messages says, as crazy as it sounds, that's true. As of July 10th, you'll be required to prove you are 18 years of age or older, such as by uploading your government ID for every adult content website you'd like to access. We don't want minors accessing our site, and we think preventing that from happening is a good thing, but putting everybody's privacy at risk won't achieve that. And it links to a video about a device-based verification and an op-ed on the topic by the Pornhub's head of community and brand. His name is Alexandra Kakesi. And there's a YouTube video on this 404 article talking about this device-based age verification. So basically what's going to happen is, I'm sure what will happen is... let me just finish this. When their time is up, Kentucky and Indiana will join multiple other states where Pornhub has blocked itself in order to maintain compliant with age verification laws, including Texas, Montana, North Carolina, Virginia, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Utah. Indiana's state enrolled Act 17 would require adult websites to verify users' ages with a government ID or another reasonable method, and is set to go into effect on July 1st. So Kentucky's law is set to go on July 15th, and Indiana is on July 1st. So we're talking in the next couple of weeks here. These are going to be happening, and they're going to start here, right? So once this legislation is passed and it's implemented, they're going to let it roll out. They're going to work out some of the kinks. What will likely happen is that Google and Apple will probably allow you to use, like, not all states, but I know Apple with the Apple Wallet allows you to upload your driver's license or state issue ID. I don't know if Google has the same thing. When I say Google, I'm talking about stock Google, not for GraphQL OS users, right? Or Calyx or whatever else you run, might be running, but just stock Android, stock Apple, allowing you to verify digitally, which is encrypted on your device, and it will be encrypted in transit, but where it's stored and how it's stored and how it's used and for what like length of time is kind of an unknown. I'm sure there will be third-party apps that start to come out that you'll see, which are just going to be more data harvesters that will say things like, hey, you know, just verify once with this verification service provider, and then any website you want to use, we can just go ahead and authenticate you because you've already authenticated with us. I expect to see that, or some version of that, sometime in the next few months, specifically here in the United States, possibly in the European Union, depending upon if this, you know, the European Union isn't exactly doing the same thing, but they're, if you're a company like Apple or Google, and you're like, oh my gosh, we have to adhere to all these laws, you can try to do and appease each country and each union by whatever laws are passed and try to keep them all separated and only implement those technologies for the users that they would impact based on geography. Or things are going to get so chaotic that you may just go full ham and say, you know what, we're just going to roll it out. We're just going to roll out for everybody. And if you have to use it, you use it. And if you don't have to use it, then you won't need to worry about it, but it'll be there. That's kind of, I think, what might happen. My previous years as a business analyst and a product manager, I think that's probably the path of least resistance, because these things are going to be in a state of flux for a very long time, meaning like there's going to be more states and different countries within the EU, or the EU is a European Union that's making laws. I mean, countries within the EU kind of have their own laws as well. They passed and have passed in the past for things like protecting privacy and other things, but when you roll it out at a larger level, like in the United States, is like right now it's happening at a state level, but if everything goes to a federal level, it just kind of like the EU is with this pending chat control bill with on-device scanning, it starts to become anxiety-ridden for the big tech companies that have to obey the law or not sell their device or services there, which they're in the business of making money. They want the most amount of users. So it's more likely that they're going to fold and bend to the law, which is going to put the users in a position of going like, what am I compromising because of these laws that are being passed somewhere else? How is that impacting me here? And that's why I said earlier, don't think just because you hear something somewhere and say, well, I don't live there. I don't live in Australia. That doesn't affect me. I don't live in the EU. That doesn't affect me. I don't live in the United States. That doesn't affect me. It might, because if you're using a stock Android or stock Apple phone, there will be changes that are coming out in their operating system releases to appease these laws, which will impact you even though you don't live there, is what I'm saying. And on the topic of Apple, I did watch the WWDC a week ago, because I'm always curious, and I'm a tech nerd. I'm a gadget freak, and I like new tech. Even if it's tech I'm not planning to use, I still want to know about it, and I want to see it. I want to try it out sometimes. I do have an iPhone, and I did install the iOS 18 beta because I want to see this stuff. I want to understand how it works. For those that have been listening for more than just this episode, you know, like my preferred device is a Pixel. I have a Pixel 7 Pro running Graphene OS, and I do have multiple profiles, and I have apps that I need to run, that require Google Play services running in a sandbox environment in those profiles, but traditionally, I like things where I have full control, or as much control as I can possibly have, over my device, what it's doing, how, who it's connecting to, what it's sending, and all that kind of stuff. With iOS 18, the new Mac OS, which is going to be called Sequoia, the new iPad OS and Watch OS and all the other OSs, I think Apple TV and all this other stuff, they're going to be rolling out their version of AI. What we know is artificial intelligence. They're going to be, they've coined Apple intelligence for their AI. And on some levels, AI is kind of cool. I've been playing with AI locally on my own server with Llama 3, and you know, also using Stable Diffusion, and I use other AI tools and my professional side. But I feel like we are way too soon to be shoehorning all this AI tech right onto our phones, because they're still figuring it out. They're still trying to understand what even models they want to use and what data is collected and how much of it needs to be collected and how is it indexed and stored. Because in order for AI to be really useful as a personal assistant, it needs access to everything about you, all of your contacts, your text messages, your photos, your email, what apps you have installed, how often you play music and what playlists you listen to and how often you text certain people versus others and group text. In order to have the best AI experience, it needs to have context about you. So these AI assistants, I'm doing like air quotes as I'm sitting here, need to have all of this information harvested about you in order to be as optimal and efficient as possible. Makes sense, right? But I feel like we are way too soon in where AI is, what it is. Some of it's fake, total crap. Some of it's actually kind of useful, right? Like when I saw the presentation on iPadOS and naturally writing on an iPad, doing equations and it actually changing in real time and graphing different formulas on screen. I'm like, this is kind of cool. Like that is cool. It's neat to see how we can utilize some of these kind of like new applications and services in a way that it does benefit people. But the trade-offs for the assistant and it being embedded and baked into the OS, it's not something you can just go in and toggle off. It's part of the operating system. It's in all of the apps. And they've also said they're going to incorporate ChatGPT, which they say when it uses ChatGPT from OpenAI, that you will have to expressly grant that permission, because they are really boasting and sitting on the shoulders of privacy for this big new release of iOS 18, macOS Sequoia, and all these different things that they're rolling out. They're saying that privacy is at the center of everything for your device. And they say that a lot of, especially for like the newer phones that have the Apple silicone processors in there, which are very high efficient, and they utilize the GPU to render these different algorithms, or not render, but process these algorithms to provide the AI functionality on device, happen on device securely without Apple knowing about it. And that when it does utilize Apple's cloud, I forget what they called it, privacy safety cloud or some crap like that. It's all marketing terms. They're saying that it's not stored. It's not stored to you. That everything is basically in a controlled environment so that even if the system was compromised, it wouldn't compromise its users. I'm taking that with a grain of salt. I'm not saying that I don't believe Apple has gone out of their way to implement privacy functionality, because they probably have, but they do that to limit their own liability and exposure for when things are broken or breached. So that way they can actually lean on the anonymization tools and, you know, to circumvent attack vectors from successfully being able to identify users. I don't exactly know how that's worked. They say that they're audited multiple times, that their code's audited and things like that. We have to take them at their word, because I've never seen any reports on third-party audits on Apple tech. On my iPhone, I do have advanced data protection enabled, which is supposed to be end-to-end encrypted for everything except for mail, calendar, and I believe contacts, which I don't use iCloud contacts anyways. That all connects to my local Nextcloud server. But everything else is theoretically, according to them, supposed to be end-to-end encrypted, meaning that not even Apple has the ability to look at data in things like iMessage and photos, notes, health data, things of that. If that's in fact 100% true, which is not, I don't have a way to verify that because it's closed source, that does make me feel like maybe Apple is a slightly better choice over Google if you're going a traditional route. I mean, the downside is you're locked into this ecosystem and this platform. If what they say is true about how they're doing their AI rollout with their private cloud, you know, hermetically sealed vault just for you, okay, at least they're putting some effort into that versus, say, like Microsoft with what they're doing with Copilot and Microsoft Recall, which I'll talk about Recall in a second. I feel like maybe they're trying to do as best as they can. Like, because, I mean, it's a big feat to try to provide all of these services without having access to your information. Like, you can't have it, you know, the way the AI models work is off of data sets. And if you want it to be, like, curated to a specific person, it needs a lot of context about that individual that makes them unique. What your likes and dislikes, what you do for your job, when do you wake up, when do you go for your workout, when do you eat, like all those things. It needs to know that in order to anticipate the needs. Otherwise, it's not intelligent at all, right? It's just an assistant where you're basically setting everything. So to make it intelligent, and I'm using that word term loosely, it needs all of this information about you. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I have Apple devices. I use Apple devices in my professional life that I will be kind of testing this stuff out and kind of giving my viewpoints about it, because some of it, I'll be honest, sounds pretty cool. Like some of the feature sets that they're talking about within applications is pretty cool. I also have this other side of me, right? That's like, well, I don't want to feed anything about my personal stuff that I don't have control over. And that's why on my personal life, like the things I do personally that are not work related, I use Linux, I use Graphene OS, I use open source as much as possible, and control my own cloud server using Nextcloud and other tools and servers that I have to host my information, my data, my files myself. I want to be the one that has access and chooses who has access to that data. So there's other parts of this too that are important depending upon where you live in the world and what the legal rights are to your data. And if it's somewhere else and you're using a third-party service, there's the third-party doctrine in the United States, which may override what you think you have as your Fourth Amendment rights to privacy in your data, because it may not be your data. So if it's not your data, it's not your server, it's somebody else's, then you, what you think, because I've seen this, I actually just saw this online, I think it was Mastodon or Twitter earlier, where people were like, well, what about the Fourth Amendment? And I just literally said, well, you should look up third-party doctrine, because you know, what you think is your data is probably not yours. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to somebody else. You're just paying to have it housed somewhere for you, but it doesn't really belong to you anymore, does it? Especially if you don't pay them. It's theirs. It's on their machine. And, you know, I won't go down that rabbit hole right now. It's just that this is kind of all happening in real time. These laws are going into effect. Some of these are going into effect. Others, we don't know. We'll have to wait and see, like the chat control thing. And another thing too, I am a longtime MySudo user, which, you know, love it, hate it. You know, it's just a tool that I use because I can fire up different virtual phone numbers. And one particular identity I have had for a couple of years now is one where I have a UK-based phone number. And this week, I've been getting a couple of notifications from my pseudo that in order to keep that UK phone number, I am going to have to KYC myself. So I did have a couple accounts that were using that phone number. I've switched them over to something else, and I'm going to be foregoing that because I'm not going to KYC myself. But just something interesting, because I didn't even know about this. So I guess if anyone's listening from the UK, come into the chat or hit me on Mastodon or Twitter or something and let me know. Is this like a rollout in the country for all phone numbers, or is it just impacting voice over IP? I'm not really sure. I haven't actually gone and investigated. I just know that in order to keep it, I was going to have to send my government issued ID to the UK in order to keep the UK phone number. And I won't get into why I had a UK number, but I had a good reason, and now I am ditching it. So that was just another, like, huh, that's interesting as far as that coming up. So I want to talk about the Windows Recall thing too, because I'm talking about Apple OS, and I want to talk about Microsoft Recall because I've noticed a trend in the last couple of months. So if you are not familiar with what Windows Recall is, and allegedly they're rolling this feature back, meaning it's going to be an opt-in, not an opt-out. So what it is, it's basically a snapshotting tool on your computer. But what it does is it snapshots your screen, as in like literally taking a screenshot of your computer like every 5 seconds or 10 seconds or when you switch from one app to another. And the way that they demonstrate it as a feature is that you can actually go into Recall and say like, oh, what was that movie I was looking at 2 days ago? Or what was that? Who was I talking to about Harry Potter? You know, and it will screenshot your computer. It will store it and it will index it based upon what it saw on the screen. So all the text and everything. So that way you can actually type into the search, you know, Harry Potter or something like that, whatever conversation you might have been having, and it will actually flip to the screen, almost like a flip book, if you will, with a slider going left to right at the top. Kind of reminds me of the old cover flow that Apple Photos or Apple iTunes used to have, where you would scroll. I don't know if you remember that, but if you used iTunes like 10 years ago, all of your cover art would flow left to right, almost like a digital jukebox. And this is kind of what it like looks like, Microsoft Recall, but it's with screenshots of your own sessions on your computer. Okay. One part says, well, that's kind of neat, right? Like, but the other part says, like, but you're also screenshotting everything on my computer. And allegedly, you can go in and say, don't screenshot when I have this application open or this application open. Okay. But the fact that they had this on by default, like out of the box, has created an uproar in the privacy, not just privacy-minded individuals, but people in corporations and companies and thinking about how this is stored. It's basically a hacker's dream to be able to compromise a system that would have Recall, because rather now than having to hack you as an individual, if they can compromise your system and get, which Windows systems are not, especially desktops, are not that hard to compromise for hackers. There's a lot of vulnerabilities, but also too, a lot of people install a lot of crap on their machines, which it exposes the computer to be more vulnerable than it was just, you know, with its normal applications installed. And it's easy to get malware and click on emails and open up, you know, different types of viruses and malware unintentionally. It's always historically been easier to do on Windows than other operating systems like Mac OS or Linux. It doesn't mean that Mac OS and Linux are safe from those. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there's more Windows users on the planet than anything else. So they're usually the biggest target. And so if you could imagine, you have a Windows 11 machine with this feature running with screenshots and history of conversations, your bank statement, credit card portals, healthcare portals. Think of all the private things you do on your computer that are just private to you that you wouldn't want other people to see. Now being exposed to a hacker who can just look at your entire timeline, who can search for things like bank account, account number, Bitcoin, you know, whatever they want to search for. And it actually just go right to the screen and they could just copy and paste like information right from there. It was almost like, on one hand, I kind of see where Microsoft was thinking like this could be a huge feature and benefit to people. But on the other hand, it's like, yeah, this is actually maybe a terrible idea. This reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Minority Report, or there's other movies too where they have like these memories that they can open up and explore and go back in time and into the future, you know, like and see things. It's kind of like that on your computer. And on one hand, I know there'd be some like cool aspects to that, but I think there's more harm that could come out of that than good. I think it's a terrible idea. Also too, these things are stored locally in a database. They're accessible through an app data directory within the registry. It's not hard to find this stuff, and it's not like it's in, like, from what I understand, it's encrypted locally, but if you are able to compromise the account, then it doesn't really matter because it's going to decrypt all those folders anyways, meaning that it was a feature baked right into the operating system. It wasn't separately protected by yet another vault that was an encrypted vault, like TrueCrypt or VeraCrypt or something like that. Is that right? It's been a long time since I used VeraCrypt. But you know how you can create a vault within VeraCrypt, encrypt that folder with a separate unique password. So like even if someone got onto your system, in order to access that information, they would have to know yet another password to unlock that. This was just baked right into, meaning that the user credentials logged in could just open it up. It wasn't separately encrypted or password protected. Now, that might change with the rollout. We don't really know. And from what we do know, it looks like Microsoft is going to be making changes with this rollout. So this was going to be baked. I say baked in, I think it's just part of the Windows 11 update. But this latest article from TechRadar, which came out 2 days ago, says the useful new features are well and good, but Microsoft needs to focus on shoring up security and privacy. So it says Microsoft flagship AI feature, which is for Copilot Plus PCs, recall has been through the ringer lately and at the risk of sounding like a hater, rightfully so. It says, in case you missed it, recall takes screenshots every few seconds, building up a library of images that you can search via AI. But the feature had some serious issues on the privacy front, to the point that the launch of recall was pulled and banished back to the Windows Insider program for further testing. The Windows Insider program is like people who test out beta releases, alpha releases of Windows. So it sounds like they're going to pull it out of the next big release, and it's now kind of like back in the Insider program for just beta testing. It says, however, that hasn't stopped Microsoft from quietly adding new features to recall as the tech giant runs damage control around this whole controversy. As discovered by well-known leaker Albacore, writing for Tom's Hardware, which is a popular tech blog, there are a few new chunky bits of functionality hidden away in the latest Windows 11 preview build in the Canary channel. So these are kind of like a beta channel for Windows 11. And Windows 11 is going to be big because I think later this year or next year, right, Windows 10 is going to be no longer supported. So if you're a Windows user, you're going to have to move to Windows 11 if you want to continue to get security updates and things of that nature. So all this stuff is Windows 11 kind of, you know, got a lot of people spooked. So it says one of these is a screen ray, which is a utility that'll pop up to analyze what's currently on the screen. It's summoned via keyboard shortcut and allows the user to get extra information from Copilot, which is Microsoft's AI tool called Copilot, about anything present on screen, or access a translation for something in a foreign language. Okay. While we have limited understanding of the exact nature of this new tool, it does seem similar to the reader feature in Safari that Apple introduced during WWDC, which leverages Apple intelligence to scan a web page and translate, summarize, or add insight to whatever content is currently being browsed. Of course, Windows 11 Recall tool is available across your entire system, not just in a browser. Alongside this, Microsoft has implemented a revamped homepage design for Windows 11's Recall feature. This means that when you fire up Recall, instead of being presented with a new snapshot, you get rid of recent snapshots. There's still a button to allow you to create new ones. This just doesn't happen by default anymore. So also is a new topic section that organizes snapshots by themes so you can group them together, related by screenshots for, say, like Spotify, make it easier for searching. It says, finally, Windows Recall also has better integration with Copilot. This new preview built, clicking on a snapshot will produce a drop-down menu with context-sensitive choices so you can get Copilot to copy something on it and in an app, or if it's an image, find pictures in the same vein or create a similar image. All the standard Copilot options are essentially baked right in. So again, we're talking a lot about AI here with Apple. They're calling it Apple Intelligence. They're going to also be using OpenAI's ChatGPT natively built into their operating system. Of course, you will be notified of what if personal information is being sent to ChatGPT, and you will have to approve that when that happens, as opposed to all the other stuff that's happening on device will stay. I'm using air quotes again, like what happens on your phone stays on your phone, whatever. Microsoft is pushing Copilot. Of course, Google has Gemini, which they're, you know, kind of baked already into their operating system for Google Assistant and stuff. It's also rolling out into their Google Messages client. So if you do use that, even if you use Google Messages on like Graphene OS because of the rich features, the tapbacks and things like that, you can kill network access to the app, which I'm not really sure I think that will limit your ability to like pull in like animated GIFs and stuff like that. I'm not really sure, but all I'll say is they're putting AI in like everywhere, putting it in to the phone, putting it into the computer, the browser, everything that you would use on a daily basis to communicate and do your research and check stuff and search for stuff. So, you know, I feel like I'm just kind of exhausted of all the AI stuff. And I think that maybe at some point down the road, as I'm adjusting my headset, at some point down the road, things will maybe normalize. But this is like, I feel like AI is like blockchain when it came out. Like all this crap got developed around it because Bitcoin, you know, became popular. So all there's 1,000 projects that kicked off and 1,000 startups and everyone trying to be first to provide the best solution or the best tool. So I don't think we're going to see this die down anytime soon. If anything, we're just getting ramped up and I'm already exhausted by it. Like I'm already like, dude, why do we have to have AI in everything? AI in your light bulb, AI in your microphone, AI in your pants. You know, like I don't need AI. Like there's things about AI that are cool and I want to use those in an environment that I can control and that like I choose what gets indexed and that kind of thing. And in that regard, there's a lot of cool models that have been open sourced and even from Apple and from Meta and from other sources and Google. I'm not sure about Google, but I think Google, where you can download and use these large language models on your own system utilizing your own graphics cards. Like I actually have a system set up with, like I said, Stable Diffusion, Llama 3. I've got some other models on there. It was very easy to install on a Pop OS machine that I have. And I just used Pop OS because it was easy to install the packages. I followed a tutorial on Network Chuck's YouTube channel and everything like works really smoothly and it's all processing locally. And it's using my NVIDIA 1080 Ti in that machine to do all of the calculating. And it's quite efficient and it's really cool. And I like playing with it when I want to play with it. I don't want to implement it on my wrist. I don't want to implement it on my phone. I don't want to implement it on my tablet and my computer and everything else. So there is a big like trend I'm seeing. I don't know if it's a trend or a fad. Hopefully it's bigger than a fad of people on YouTube who have pretty good size audiences that are kind of saying, whoa, this might be a good time to start looking at using Linux on the desktop instead of Windows because of all of this stuff that's coming that you cannot turn off. And even if you opt out, it's still running. You have the AI, you've got Recall, you know, AI's Copilot in this instance with Microsoft, on top of already Microsoft just historically being really terrible at protecting your data, and not protecting your data, but being bad at exploiting your telemetry for advertising purposes, and who knows what else they're collecting and storing on you. And Microsoft, I mean, yes, you can set up a Windows machine without having to log in, but it's getting harder. Just kind of like Apple does the same thing with their Apple IDs. Like it's getting harder and harder to just have a device where you can just turn it on, set up a few settings and preferences and just use the device. You have to log into it, which is typically an email account of some kind with Microsoft. You know, it's, you know, your Windows Live ID or Windows ID or whatever the hell it is. With Apple, it's Apple ID. I only know because I have one gaming computer that's a laptop with Windows 10 on it, and I log in with the same email that's connected to my Xbox account. That's all I do on that laptop. And then otherwise it just sits in a corner. The battery is actually not even functional anymore because I just use it when I travel. There's a couple games I like to play. And so I'm like, I hate that, right? That I am connected through that laptop to be able to play those games. But my other machines, like my ThinkPad and my desktop, which are running Linux, like I don't log into them. I just install the OS and I create a local account and then I do what I want. Those days are like gone with Microsoft and Apple. So there's a lot. If you just go on YouTube or any, we'll talk about YouTube another time. I don't even know if I'll get to the ad stuff and Manifest V2 and V3. I'm going to try to touch on it. But there's a trend, or I'm seeing at least maybe just the algorithm serving it up to me, a lot of gamers and technology enthusiasts who are ditching Windows and trying Linux, and they're experimenting Linux with like for 30 days or 60 days and trying different distributions. And I think it's cool because it exposes a lot more people to like how far Linux has come for the desktop and how easy it is to actually install and kind of utilize right out of the box. You don't have to be a command line warrior or a developer or an engineer to use the operating system as an opt-out of Microsoft Windows or an opt-out of Apple Mac OS. It's actually fairly easy. And so if you are considering trying it, I highly encourage you to give it a whirl. You can actually run most of these Linux distributions virtually, like live off the USB without even installing anything first. I recently just switched my mom over on her ThinkPad to Linux Mint using Cinnamon. It took us, you know, like an hour to get everything set up. We set up her Nextcloud agent, which is automatically backing up specified folders in her home directory. We got application install, you know, all the apps that she would need installed just from the package manager application tool running on the desktop. Like everything was really easy to set up. And that's actually the first time I've ever used Linux Mint for like more than an hour. I've actually never really messed with it, but we were having some issues with Pop OS on her machine. And so I decided, oh, you know what? Like, let's give Linux Mint a go. And it's been working really well for her. I personally, like, I, you know, am kind of a distro hopper. So like, I'm currently running Arch Linux. I've been running CubesOS lately, which I would not recommend for new people, as well as Pop OS. Great, you know, but any Debian distro, most of these Debian-based distros work really well, like Ubuntu, Pop OS, Linux Mint. Those are all Ubuntu-based. Debian-based. So those are typically like really good places to start if you've never really used Linux before. If you have a little bit more technical knowledge, you don't need a ton though. Fedora has actually been really, really cool. I was running Fedora before I switched back to Arch, which was for another day, another topic for another day. I just missed the AOR. I'm just stuck in my ways. But Fedora was awesome. I was actually running the Nobara version, which includes some helpers to install things like your graphics drivers and games. It's kind of geared towards gaming, but allows you to get, you know, restricted codecs and things installed very easily, like just clicking install, literally. That's it. So I will talk more about Linux and desktop and stuff probably in future episodes, because I feel like it might be our last hope or our last, you know, chance at sovereignty in computing, both on the phone, Linux as in Android, as in de-Googled, like Graphene OS, and Linux on our desktops, and using free and open source software to make sure that you're not being like opted into something simply by you doing an operating system update overnight and it just turns something on that you didn't really want on, like Microsoft Recall or some of these AI features that are going to have to scan your system and index it and understand who you are and what you do in order to be the best AI assistant it can be. I don't know. I feel like there's a sentiment of like privacy is dead kind of a thing. And I don't really feel that way, but I feel like it's getting a lot more challenging to use technology, but also being privacy focused. And that's why I said in the beginning of the podcast, you know, let's not confuse like privacy. It's not about hiding. It's not about being anonymous, but more about revealing what you want to whom and on what terms. So, and like you're choosing information to share. You're choosing when to reveal your location or some piece of identity about yourself, rather than it just always harvesting it all the time and you feeling like you don't have any control. That is really kind of the ethos of what this whole podcast for me is like my intent isn't to be anonymous. It may be sometimes to be anonymous, but like not all the time am I trying to be anonymous 100% of the time. Now, some of you are, and I know, like, from our conversations in the Matrix chat, some of you are like, yo, I don't even turn my phone on until I'm 5 miles from my house. And like, and I love that stuff. I just, it's not a practical implementation for me in my life right now with what I do, because I work from home, I have a business, I've got, you know, colleagues and employees that were, you know, always collaborating, and I have to share a lot of information, like data, like video files and photos and databases and stuff with each other. I cannot work in a 100% anonymous environment. Now, if I worked like at a location and I worked for a company and had just company issued stuff, sure, I could try to be a lot more anonymous, but I don't really have a desire. Me personally, I don't really have a desire to be anonymous all the time. It's more like selecting what profile or what version of myself that I want to share in that moment. So if I'm registering for a new website service or something like that, like an account online or something, I'm going to give them a simple login email alias. I'm going to generate a unique password with KeePassXC or Bitwarden. I'm going to store it so that that combination of that password and that email address only exists for one thing, and oftentimes only one email per service. Like, I'm trying to be really, really diligent about making sure I'm using email aliases for every account that I can. It's a little more work, but it's not really that much more. And with tools like Simple Login, it makes it a lot easier. So once you, my process is this. Let's say I'm going to sign up for, let's use this as an example. I just registered for 10K a couple days ago on the 17th. I registered for it. So I needed to create an account for my registration. Okay, that's fine. Like, I'd rather not have to create an account, but if that's what I have to do, cool. So I open up Simple Login. I create a new alias, right? And then in the notes, I put what it's for and I put the name of the 10K. So if I need to search it or if I'm looking at stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, that's that, that's that. Then I go to Bitwarden. I create a new entry for the 10K website, which it's a website where tons and tons of races are at. So I know I'm probably going to sign up for other races on this website. So fine, I put in the name of it. So I generate an alias, and then I generate a unique password. I put that in Bitwarden, right? So now if this site gets breached, which, come on, it's a website for registering for marathons and 10Ks and stuff, it's going to get breached at some point. I don't really care. I mean, I kind of care, but I mean, I'm not caring in the sense where if they get those credentials, if they get that email address and that password, well, it was only ever generated once and just for that one website. That email address isn't used anywhere else, and the combination of the email address and password are only used on that website. So am I being anonymous? Well, no, I guess someone could correlate transaction data, like how I paid for the registration online, to that account, and maybe. But what I've done, though, is I've made myself a very small, annoying target. Because if I hacked that website and I got a dump, and let's be real, most of them are going to be Gmail accounts, and those people that use the Gmail use that Gmail address for everything. That's where I'm going to start. I'm not going to go with the guy who, or a girl who registered as some archaic, weird, you know, alias, and then at simplelogin.com. Like, that's actually the first one I'm going to be like, yeah, I'm not going to bother, right? Because I know it's going to be a waste of time. So going back to, you know, privacy isn't about hiding. It's about revealing what you want and to whom on your terms, is the concept of saying, I'm not trying to be completely invisible. I'm trying to be a pain in the ass for the data breachers, for the hackers. I'm trying to just limit my exposure and potential threats by using tools and being mindful and aware about who I give my information to, what that information is, and knowing and expecting that at some point it's going to be exploited, you know, for something. Either sold to a data broker or breached and dumped online in a zip file or a .sql file somewhere. So that's kind of the, you know, the mindset that I'm at with that. I want to touch on another thing. We're at an hour and 20 minutes, so I don't want to make this too long of a podcast episode, but there's just a lot. This is kind of like important stuff. This one is also important. This is Manifest V2 and V3. If you've heard anything about the Google cracking down on ad blockers and things like that, That is part of what's called their Manifest V3 rollout for the way that the extensions specification is going to work with Chrome and Chromium-based browsers. So this will impact other browsers like Brave and other, even Microsoft Edge browsers that are built off of the Chromium toolkit, which a lot of them are. The ones that aren't are like Firefox or Safari or LibreWolf or some of these other forks of like Firefox or something like that. I'm sure there's more. I'm just trying to delineate between the two, or more than two, but delineate between Chromium and non-Chromium. So Manifest V3 is like a new spec. It's an extension specification that's being rolled out, and it's going to impact everything from ad blockers to how cookies are tracked and how website super cookies work and things like that. So it introduces changes to that, and it limits the ability of what extensions can do to block certain types of content, including ads. So giving website owners and advertisers more control over what users see, you know, it means that the ad blockers may not work, or they may not work as effectively, or they may just stop working altogether, and making it harder to control, you know, the browsing behavior. So the impact on blockers is, it says, the changes in Manifest V3 have significant implications for ad blockers. Some popular ad blockers, such as Adblock and uBlock Origin — I use uBlock Origin, I use it in Firefox — may need to adapt to the new specifications or risk being rendered ineffective. It says this has led to concerns about the future of ad blocking and the potential for users to lose control over their browsing experience. So Google's justification is they're citing concerns about performance and security, which there might be some valid concerns around the security aspect and locking down like what extensions have access to on your machine, like especially like physical devices that are plugged in, like your microphone, webcam, stuff like that. And they claim that the specification will improve the overall performance of Chrome and reduce the risk of malicious extensions. However, critics argue that the changes are unnecessary and will ultimately benefit advertisers at the expense of users. So what are some alternatives, you know, to Chrome? Like I said, Firefox is a good solution. I know a lot of people aren't really fans of that. There's some others that, you know, Safari probably isn't an option unless you're on macOS. I personally really don't use much outside of Firefox and Brave. Those are kind of my two go-tos. I do utilize the Mulvad browser quite a lot, but that may not be available to everyone in your platform. But it's a very good browser. If you just want to download a browser and just use it, the Mulvad browser, and it's free, from the makers of the Mulvad VPN, which I'm a big fan of, it works really well, and it does really well on the Hide Your Tracks website, where you can check to see, you know, if your browser is leaving much of a fingerprint. But if you're like a power user, meaning like you have extensions installed, like uBlock Origin and stuff like that, Firefox or Firefox type browsers might be a better route. I know there's a lot of Brave users that use Brave. I like Brave too. But there might be some impacts to the way Brave works because it is a Chromium-based browser. So we'll see. I'm not totally sure on all of that, but I wanted to put those keywords in your head. Manifest V3, ad blocking, kind of correlate the two. So as you see news and you see stuff coming out, this will also impact like YouTube, ad blockers and sponsor block too. They're trying to put a kibosh on all of the ad blocking. And what I'm seeing, not personally, but I've seen other people post screenshots, is that Firefox is even detecting — not Firefox, I'm sorry, my brain is in a fog today — YouTube is detecting whether or not you potentially might be using ad blockers. So it's asking you to log into your YouTube account in order to view the content. So there's some gatekeeping going on there as well from YouTube, and limiting what content you have access to based upon what your browser you're using or what extensions you're using. See how the internet's kind of shrinking, right? Like, I mean, if you would just want to like watch some porn and you're in Indiana, like you're screwed unless you want to send your ID, right? I mean, could you get around it using a VPN and telling it that you're in a different state? Probably, right? Probably. But that's not the point. The point is that these things are happening, and I feel like it's going to get worse. I feel like it's going to get worse before it gets better. And this is just another thing, another area of control that Google is flexing. And so by that, I say, you know, protest. Don't use Google products. pay for products. Stop using Google search. Google search is broken anyways. It is such a cesspool of ads and AI content snippets. It's just, it used to be still usable. Like, if you're that type of person like me, like, you probably use StartPage or, you know, some other alternative search engine, maybe Brave Search or something else. And every once in a while, you'll do a search, and it might be, like, so new or so technical that you copy your search, and you're like, fine, I'm just going to go to Google real quick and put this in, because Google might actually serve you a better result that was very nuanced and specific to something, like maybe an error code while you're compiling something or something nuanced. But now it's just so crapified that I don't even do that anymore. Like, most of the alternative search engines are actually way better. And StartPage is good because it is using like Google search results, but it's like filtering out all the crap, all the personalized search. It's filtering out all the ads and sponsored, you know, shopping stuff, all that crap. I just want the organic results. Give me the best results based upon my query. So I don't know. I feel like things are just really going downhill quickly this year between all of the, you know, proposed mass surveillance, Google getting really just kind of diabolical with their properties and with YouTube and ad blocking and Manifest V3. And then with all the AI stuff across the board, you know, for Microsoft, for Apple, for Google, everyone is trying to be the best AI solution to everybody. And AI, like, we're still figuring this out. We don't even have a lot of like safeguards or guardrails for AI as far as like, I mean, just today, I didn't talk about it in here, but just today I did see an article where even Google is getting smacked around for indexing images of AI celebrities on like child bodies, like bodies of children. I mean, just stupid stuff. Like, how is this even, I mean, this wasn't like turning safe browser search off mode. None of that. It was like organic search results. It's, I was trying to find the article. I scrolled past it on Mastodon earlier and I was like, I should have noted it. But I'm just saying, like, we're so new in all of this that let's not bake it into everything yet. I don't need AI in the vacuum cleaner, right? I don't need AI in the phone. I don't need it in all these places. Like, let me selectively use it when I want to. And they're already, all of them are like first to shove it in your phone and your computer, your operating system, everything. And so I just feel like this might be the beginning of the end, you know, for the revolt. the revolt, at least, let's start with the digital revolt by like, you know, running your own stuff. I'm sorry. If you're one of those people that is like, well, I don't really like, I don't want to learn new technology and stuff like that. Like, I get it, but you're going to have to. Otherwise, you're going to be a subject. You're going to be a subscriber. You're not going to be in control of your information, of your data, of your experience. When I say experience, I mean like what your personal experience is and how it impacts you, like real world impacts to you from the side effects of just relying on these big techs to like do everything for you. So a couple of things that I, you know, kind of wanted to talk for myself for my game plan for 2024, being that we're kind of like at the mid-year point right now going forward as we're in like mid-June, is I want to implement more network attached storage devices in my environment so that I can have even more data backup, more information storing, as well as continuing to experiment with moving my professional work environment from macOS over to Linux. I do a fair amount of video work. So Final Cut Pro has been like what me and my team uses, and we collaborate. We have third-party tools. It would be a big migration. It would probably, it would happen in chunks for me. I wouldn't be able to do it all overnight because we work with so much media, transcoding, different codecs from different cameras. Linux is difficult for that, even using DaVinci Resolve, which is also why I have been distro hopping. Like, I'm trying to figure out, and it looks like maybe Fedora or Arch might be where I go long term for that. It might be something like Fedora, to be honest with you, to be able to do production work. Now, I might not get fully there 100%, but I'm trying to at least just be like, can I get 50% there? Can I get 75% there? Because maybe then within another couple of years, I could be completely out of the Apple computer space for work and just be doing everything on Linux, both personal and work. That would be ideal. That'd be the best. So that's my own personal goal, is to try to get closer to that by the end of this year. I don't really expect to be a whole lot further than I am now. But the reason why I'm talking about this is because it is a process. It does nothing you do like this happens quickly overnight in a week or a month or even a year. Sometimes it can take a long time to extract yourself from Google, extract yourself from Apple or Facebook or whatever it is that's got you. You know, oh, well, all my photos are there. You know, okay, well, use NT Photos. Oh, but NT Photos isn't free. Yeah, you're going to pay for it. You're either going to pay for it by hosting your own server, or you're going to pay a privacy-respecting company, like maybe Proton Mail, Tuta Mail, something instead of Gmail, or you're going to pay for your VPN, like Proton VPN, Mulvad VPN, iVPN. Those are the ones that I would recommend, no affiliation. They're just what I've been paying for and using for a long time. You're going to pay for your stuff. You're not going to get it for free anymore. You're going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it with your money and your time. When you accept that, then you can start moving into the next phase, right? Of like what it truly means to be free from the shackles of the large tech companies. So you have to be able to willing to put in the time. Yes, it does help if you have someone that can help you. I agree. And some people just are not technical. I understand. But anyone can move their, you know, switch email providers. It might take some time. And don't delete your old Gmail account. Don't delete it. Don't let somebody else get it after you, right? Just stop using it. And use an email alias. I like Simple Login. You can also, there's some DIY ways to do that as well if you run your own mail server. But another thing I suggested in the past is like register a domain name. So that you, and set up your email off of that, and you can set up your own domain with email, with Tuta, with Proton Mail. There's other email providers. Those are the two popular ones. And that way, if you ever decide to move your email somewhere, it's a lot easier because all you're doing now is you download a copy of all your email, you change your MX records for your DNS to point to a different email provider, maybe yourself, but you keep the domain name. The domain is yours. You own it. So let's just, you know, use a Pixel. You own Pixel.com, right? That's stupid, I guess, but whatever. Let's just say you own Pixel.com. So your email address is john@pixel.com, but you host your email with Proton Mail. And maybe for whatever reason, you don't want to host with Proton Mail anymore. You can easily move that over to another email service provider like Tuta Mail by just updating. Once you sign up for the service, it'll tell you like, hey, update your MX records with these addresses. You go to your DNS provider. Maybe it's Namecheap or Hover or whoever you're using, 1984, whatever, wherever you registered or hosting, you know, you just log in, you change those MX records, and now you point it to Tuta Mail, but you still have john@pixel.com. That is your email. You own it, as opposed to moving from blah, blah, john@gmail.com to john@protonmail.com. Well, now you're now kind of, yeah, that's better. It's better than Gmail, and pay Proton Mail for the account, right? Like you're paying for the service. But it'd be better if you could just keep, if you had something like that you owned, so you can move that domain and all the email accounts you have set up for it to a different provider if you so choose. And that's what I talk about in the freedom of choice, choosing, owning your stuff. Because otherwise, if someone else owns it, you might be at the mercy of like them selling the company to another company, closing down, all of that kind of stuff. Also, don't forget LavaBit. I also use LavaBit. I don't think they ever really get much attention, but they've been a really good email provider for me for the last few years. So anyways, yeah, I guess there's a lot to kind of think about and check out. The most important things I would say right now is just to see what the outcome of this chat control bill is for the EU. We're going to see how some of these ID verification laws, how they get implemented and how they're enforced, at least here in the United States. And I live in the US, so I'll be able to kind of like see how that pans out. And then, you know, just what applications are going to be coming out from this, and how the, if this chat control bill passes, it's going to be really interesting to see how the big tech companies are going to have to alter their software and implement on-device scanning, especially, you know, like, does it impact only the people where those laws are in effect? Or are they just going to say, screw it, roll it out across the board? I mean, don't forget, Apple did try to roll out CSAM on-device scanning some years back. I want to say, was it 2018, 19, 20, somewhere around there? And then they got a ton of pushback and pulled it out. But, you know, that might very well be coming right back to a phone near you. I don't know. So anyways, thanks for listening. I have some guests coming on the next podcast episodes, which I think might be later this week, actually. So we're still working through that. So keep a lookout for that. If you have any questions, reach out to me. I have all my contact information in the show notes. You can hit me on Mastodon. Sometimes I'm on Twitter, but not very often these days. And of course, you can always hit me up on email, simon@closednetwork.io. So until I catch you in episode 36, I hope you're all doing well, looking sexy, smelling fine, and I'll catch you in the next one. Oh yeah, whoa, look, they can never keep me down, I'm going, and if I ever fail, just know I'll go again. I never quit, because I know that every loss may lead to another win. I'm going up. I bet when I land, they gon' tell me it's luck again. See that I'm winning, it's harder to watch. I'm setting the stage, you should give me my prize. You ain't got no soul, you lacking the spirit. You talk out your neck, I'ma show you I'm with it. I've been really happy you to sit and watch me win again and win again and win again. I know it's probably getting old, me and winning synonyms. So if I ever win again, it's nobody the minimum. I didn't have to sell my soul.